This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, weeks of xenophobic in South Africa sparks a discussion about migration, and thousands of mourners pay their last respect to former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Weeks of xenophobic attacks in South Africa have sparked a discussion about migration, hate crimes, and how to make sure the country's economy works for everyone. Business owners in South African cities have been the victims of violence and looting as resentment against foreigners reached a boiling point. On a personal note, I had a family member, my cousin, affected by this violence. His name, Tedros Tedla, a businessman, lived for 20 years in South Africa. Last week, attackers came to his establishment. He was scared, got into his car to flee the scene. High-speed chase commenced, his car overturned, and he died. VOA's Salem Solomon has been following the goings-on in South Africa. First, welcome to Africa News Tonight, Salem.
Thanks for having me.
Salem, what can you tell us about these attacks?
First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing that story. And that story really illustrates what this violence does to families and communities. Attacks against foreigners in South Africa are not new. According to the website XenoWatch, which tracks such incidents, more than 500 attacks occurred between 1994 and 2018. The attacks seem to spike periodically, more than 100 attacks in 2008, leaving more than 60 people dead, and more than 70 attacks occurred in 2015. This year alone, there's been more than 40 incidents recorded. More than half of the incidents unfolded in Johannesburg, the country's largest city.
What are the causes of these attacks?
Well, different observers have pointed to different causes. One major event for this recent attack that we saw was a strike by South African truck drivers who protested the hiring of foreign drivers. And this specific event and corresponding hatred rhetoric by politicians whipped up anger against foreigners. Another cause is widespread unemployment. The unemployment rate sits at 29% nationwide and is much higher in the poorer townships. In fact, just yesterday at a university graduation, Mogeng Mogeng, the Chief Justice of South Africa's Constitutional Court, said hunger, not xenophobia, was the cause of violence. Here's how he put it: desperate people resort to desperate measures.
But you mentioned that violence against foreigners has historical roots. Can you explain some of the history?
Yes. So South Africa, of course, has been a multicultural country for centuries. Bishop Desmond Tutu famously called it a rainbow nation because of its diversity. But this diversity has often brought tension. During the time of apartheid, the white minority government placed strict residency restrictions on the black majority, forcing many to live in poor areas known as townships. When migrants or immigrants arrived and looked for business opportunities, they often found that these same townships were the only places where they could afford to open shops. So this bred anger and resentment, and politicians and others have sought to capitalize on the anger as a way to explain the lack of economic opportunities and unemployment in the country. Hatred rhetoric has led to violence.
So, Salem, for a more clearer understanding of the matter, could you just break up the makeup of foreign nationals in South Africa?
So today, according to reports that we've seen, South Africa is more home to about 3.6 million foreign nationals who make up about 7% of the population. The majority, about 70%, come from the neighboring countries like Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Lesotho, according to recent report we saw at the BBC. But there are also large numbers of people people from India, China, and other parts of the African continent, like Ethiopia and Nigeria. Many of the poorer residents of South Africa's townships resent the economic success, however modest, these immigrants have had. So this is the source of the tension, and there is no easy solution to it.
No easy solution. VOA Salem Salomon, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
Thousands of mourners filed into a Harare stadium today to pay their respects to former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, who died last week at the age of 95. The leader's family say his funeral will be held in accordance with the government's wishes in Harare's Heroes Acres Cemetery, but that his burial will come later and will be private. VOA's Anita Powell files from Harare.
Thousands of Harare residents lined up in the blazing sun to pay final respects to the man who cast a long shadow over Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe's body is laying in state for 2 days at this Harare stadium ahead of his Saturday memorial service and Sunday burial. The first president of independent Zimbabwe died last week, 2 years after he was pushed out of power by his deputy, who had the support of the military. Mugabe's family said Friday they had, after negotiations with the government, agreed to have him buried in Harare's Heroes Acre Cemetery, instead of in his rural village, as they had wanted. But his nephew, Leo, says the actual interment will be private.
I'm happy personally,
he says, because he's being given what belongs to him, a befitting send-off. His legacy is being recognized, and they are doing things that they've never done at the National Heroes Acre. Some mourners, like 51-year-old war veteran and farmer Victoria Muwana, say they came to show gratitude.
I benefited a house in Nyanga and also a land. When I was working before, I once worked as a policewoman. So I managed to benefit. Since I was in the housing committee and land, I worked very hard with him, so I benefited. I was the one who also benefited through his program.
Others came to seek closure, like unemployed mourner Maxwell board member Bonga, who is 47.
We are bereaved, we are mourning, we are crying, and we don't know. We are going. You left us without telling us what we should do, where we should go.
Mugabe's legacy is likely to be a mixed one. He is hailed as a liberation hero, but reviled as the man responsible for steering the nation's economy into ruin. But for 75-year-old retiree Love Mormurewa, who could hardly speak between sobs, the man he calls by his clan name, Gashungu, left a deep impression on his life. It is greatly pained me, he says in the Shona language, for me to be who I am today. It's all thanks to Gashungu. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
The UN Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, reports a surge in intercommunal conflict in central Mali is worsening humanitarian conditions for millions of people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from OCHA headquarters in Geneva.
UN officials report the number of people needing humanitarian assistance since the beginning of the year has surged by 22% to nearly 4 million. It says one in five people in Mali is dependent upon international aid for survival. During the same period, OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the number of people forced to flee from intercommunal violence has doubled to more than 168,500. He says increased displacement is causing severe food shortages.
When people are simply removed from where they grow their food or where they have their livestock, well, they don't have access to that and they don't get the level of food that they need. But of course, when the needs increase and we don't see a marked significant increase of the security with which we can deliver aid, that is a huge problem.
Another huge problem is lack of money. Laerke says the UN has revised its appeal upwards by 10%. Unfortunately, he says, only 30% of the $324 million requested has been received. Consequently, he tells VOA, OCHA has been forced to cut back on a number of important programs in order to pay for the most basic life-saving needs, such as food and potable water.
I can tell you that there are certain sectors that are critically underfunded. For example, health has received 2.8% of the financing that they were asking for. That means that a lot of health projects which had been designed and were ready to begin simply can't take off. They don't start.
Laerke says other critically underfunded programs include education, protection, water and sanitation. He notes the loss of these programs have serious consequences for the present and future well-being of the population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
15 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The U.S. Treasury Department says it is freezing all U.S. assets of Rwanda's former Inspector General of Police for alleged human rights abuses and corruption. The action today also includes a visa ban to the U.S. for Kali Aisuhura and members of his immediate family. A Treasury Department statement says Kayahura used corruption and bribery to strengthen his political position. He also led the police department's flying squad unit in allegedly using inhumane treatment of detainees at the Nalfanya Special Investigation Center. African nutrition experts are urging governments to address the growing problem of poor nutrition in sub-Saharan Africa. Eugene Wimana has details from Kigali.
Mukazirimo Bagabo Francine is a 27-year-old mother of three, and she is a fourth. All three of her children have started growth because of undernourishment. Francine says her husband abandoned her and she can't afford to properly feed them. She says, these children are still very little. To work for them alone is difficult for me. Their father has abandoned them. That's where my nutrition comes from. World Health Organization say the prevalence of stunting in Africa decreased from 38% in 2000 to 30% in 2007. However, the WHO says the number of people affected on the continent increased from about 51 million to 59 million because of population growth. Stunted growth is the result of chronic malnutrition, either from a shortage of food or from poor quality food. Aside from harming overall health, stunting hurts brain development and can lead to lifelong learning disabilities. Members of the Federation of African Nutrition Societies, who recently met in Kigali, say their first role is to educate Africans how to cook nutritious food. Dr. Christine Mukanhwari is the president of the Rwanda Nutritionist Society. Mukanhwari says they educate people not to only fill their plate. People have to know what to put on it. The food must contain all important food groups, be it vegetables, protein, fruits, grains. She says they recommend that pregnant mothers get adequate nutrition if they want to give birth to intellectuals for this continent. Ngozi Nam, the director of the Federation of African Nutrition Societies, FANUS, says nutrition is key to the continent's development. She and other experts are asking governments to invest in what they call village kitchens to make sure that the future of Africa is being properly fed.
It is important to note that nutrition is the key to achieving sustainable development goals. A country that does not give adequate attention to nutrition will never develop.
Village kitchens help parents learn the healthiest ways to cook locally grown produce. Community residents working with nutrition teachers share food and cooking techniques aimed at boosting child nutrition. While undernutrition in children is still a problem, some African countries have reduced the occurrence of stunting. For example, the Rwandan government says stunting in the country declined to 38% of children under 5 in 2015, down declined from 51% in 2010. In Ghana, stunting declined to 13% of young children in 2014 from 20 in 2008. In Kenya, it declined from 33% to 23% between 2008 and 2013. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Weeks of xenophobic attacks in South Africa sparks a discussion about migration. Thousands of mourners pay their last respect to former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. And the UN reports a surge in the intercommunal conflict in central Mali. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Ugandans. Scientists are in the advanced stages of breeding genetically modified mosquitoes to help fight malaria. They say the modified male mosquitoes are sterile and will be released to counter the females, which spread the malaria and keep them from breeding. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
With Uganda ranking fifth among African countries with highest malaria prevalence, scientists and the government are exploring elimination of the female mosquitoes to help fight the disease. An insectary has been set up at the Uganda Virus Research Institute, where sterile male mosquitoes will be hatched before they are released into the environment to counter the females. Dr. Jimmy Opigo is the head of the Malaria Control Program in Ministry of Health.
We are producing genetically modified mosquitoes to go and fight the naturally bred mosquitoes. The genetically modified mosquitoes will work to produce their offsprings to be mostly male. And then a male mosquito does not transmit malaria, does not bite people. And then it will make also the few female to be less fertile.
Dr. Jonathan Kayondo is a researcher with the Uganda Virus Research Institute. He says the project targets eliminating female anopheles, mosquitoes.
We are targeting the major actors in the disease transmission, and here it is Anopheles gambis. So that's one of the three species that are responsible. So we think that if this could be targeted in a very precise way, in the way genetic modification can enable us to do, we can curb the malaria transmission. Of course, that's the big idea. So
he says if the trial is successful and safe, the GM mosquitoes will be released in villages plagued by malaria across Africa. Dr. Andrew Chigundu is one of the Ugandan scientists involved in the trials. He cites some countries where GM mosquitoes have proven successful in the fight against malaria.
In Brazil, in Florida, it has been used. In actual fact, in one island in Malaria, mosquitoes don't exist anymore. Because if you release several times, eventually all females die. All the eggs they hatched die, and the males who you released die of natural death.
The Ugandan project is part of other running projects in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Ghana. However, the Ugandan scientists are still facing a hurdle of absence of a law to regulate creation of genetic material. Although Parliament approved Uganda's National Biotechnology and Biosafety Bill 2012 into law, President Yoweri Museveni has refused to assent to it. The bill seeks to provide a regulatory framework that facilitates the safe development and application of biotechnology, research, development, and release of genetically modified organisms. In a letter to the Speaker of Parliament, Rebecca Kadaga, the President recommended that the law addresses the matter of mixing GMO materials and non-GMO seed materials before his assent. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
In the past decade, the world has seen significant advances towards eliminating malaria infections and deaths. But in some regions, progress has slowed, according to the World Health Organization. Sheila Pony reports from South Sudan, where, due to years of conflict and environmental conditions, malaria may be finding a new foothold.
In South Sudan, mosquito-borne malaria is the leading cause of sickness and death in children under 5 years old. Program Director for National Malaria Control Program, Harriet Akelo Pasquale, monitors the number of infections across the country.
This year, so far, we have seen that a number of counties have reported an increase above the normal of what they used to report in the past years. So from our weekly reports, 25 counties have been identified to report increase in malaria cases compared to the previous years.
As South Sudan enters the peak of this year's rainy season, the sound of their children crying from anti-malarian injections is something that mothers such as Faida Shamima are living through, but struggle to understand. Her daughter is only 9 months old.
I brought her to the hospital. Her body was weak. She was vomiting and having diarrhea, and I was told she has malaria. I really don't know what to do about this malaria. Even after treatment, it keeps coming back.
Pasquale says that the patient overload can overwhelm medical workers.
Annually, we see about 4 million cases reported from the health facility mainly.
Dr. Morbe Taban, the medical director at Al Shabah Hospital for Children, added 7 of every 10 cases they treat at the only children's hospital in South Sudan are malaria related.
We have 12 to 14 medical doctors in the hospital, and I think we're now receiving 3 times more than our capacities. So we need more doctors, we need more human resource.
This year, heavy rain and poor infrastructure, filled swamps, flooded streets and overloaded channels creating ideal breathing conditions for mosquitoes. Sue Okwana is the director of communication for MedAir. They provide medicine, treatment and treated mosquito nets to many rural parts of the country where malaria is on the rise.
So in our clinics, which we operate in a wheel, rank and lair, we are noticing an increase of cases in all of those locations, particularly in Awil County. For instance, we had 797 cases reported in August of 2018. This year, August 2019, we had 1,300 cases. So it has increased this year over last year.
However, experts remain positive. They say with enough resources, commitment and political will, malaria-related illness and death can be reduced in South Sudan and perhaps even eliminated. Sheila Oponi for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa. Stand up!